You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Earlier this week, Thomas Nail, a professor of philosophy at the University of Denver in the United States, wrote an article titled, "Why is walking so good for the brain? Blame it on the spontaneous fluctuations." This article spoke about walking, how it affects our brains, and whether it could actually help students in school to remember better, to think more creatively, and to help build more positive relationships between both students and teachers. Given that New Zealand has gone back into lockdown, we, as a result, are going on a lot more walks. So Zazi wanted to speak to Thomas about this research and see if walking should continue to remain part of our daily lives past the lockdown climate, as well as being incorporated into our education systems. Zazi began by asking Thomas what the connection is between walking and thinking.
Thinking. So my assumption was that walking is good for you. That's what my intuition. I felt like I had read enough of the, you know, articles and things that I believed that walking is good for your thinking. It helps you think, is what my vague memory from reading articles on the internet about walking helping you think. And there's all these anecdotal stories too about, you know, great thinkers and Einstein discovering general relativity while he's on his bicycle and moving around, and these stories from intellectual history where great thinkers have had epiphanies and insights while walking. And that was the level at which I had begun thinking about thinking and walking. There's a longer history that goes certainly back to the ancient Greek philosophers who similarly did philosophy while walking. So Socrates, a lot of his dialogues, he's moving around and he's taking a walk. Aristotle is famous for walking around a series of colonnades, and you know, so he and his followers were called the peripatetics, which means that they were ambling and they were walking around. So he would teach while he was walking. And the Stoics, and there's a number of other philosophers that have this history of thinking and walking. And I just assumed that connection was straightforward. And then I started digging into it, and it turns out that thinking is a very broad topic. Well, what kind of thinking? How does it help you think? You know, what do you mean by helping you think? Helping you think about what? And so that question hadn't been answered actually until 2014. And I found this article where some researchers at Stanford had tried to answer this question: how does walking help you think? So they took two different types of thinking, of which there's some sort of standard social psychological tests and measurements of what constitutes what's called divergent thinking, which is creative thinking, associative thinking. And some of the basic tests are like, I'm going to give you three objects and you tell me like what alternate uses, how many alternate uses can you give for these objects? So like button, how many different uses are there for a button aside from being on a shirt or something like that? And then you have to just generate all these associations, and that how many associations and alternate uses you can make, not associations, but alternate usage of that object, that determines how creative you are. So anyway, that was the test they had for divergent creative thinking and association. And then the other test they had was for sort of convergent or synthetic thinking. I give you three words. In the test, they gave the participants three words, and you have to figure out what the connection is between those three words. So cottage, Swiss, and cake. What is the convergent synthesis word that ties those three words together? And the answer is cheese. These are the kinds of activities to measure these things. In any case, the experiment showed that these were students on a college campus, were given these questions, and they were given the questions while sitting and given the questions while walking. And they were, you know, comparing which one. So it turns out actually that when you walk, people have always said that it just helps you think, but it helps you think in a very specific way that's unique, is that when you're walking, it increases dramatically, like 60% increase in creativity when you're walking, divergent thinking, association, and actually your convergent thinking decreases. Not nearly 60%, but it goes down. I think it was like 10% or 20% or something. So you actually become less kind of rational and linear, and your convergent thinking suffers as you walk. But the benefit is that you get all this creative, and this is why all of those great thinkers and, you know, Einstein and all these mathematicians and so on had some of these incredible epiphanies while walking. They knew already enough of their profession I'm not going to go to walk around and discover general relativity. I don't know fundamental physics in that way. That's not my discovery to make. But if I already knew all of the problems, if I went for a walk, it might catalyze my creativity and I might think well outside the box of other possibilities, but I'd have to have that knowledge base to begin to kind of associate and experiment and think in alternate ways about things.
These beneficial effects of walking, do they apply to walking on a treadmill, for example, or is it linked to walking outside in the environment?
Yes. So these studies were done walking outside in the environment. The study does suggest that there are limitations to the study, and one of those limitations is you'd want to know whether it was a treadmill or not. I've looked at other studies that were focusing on other things, and one of those was treadmill walking, but it was a different study associated with reciting hexameter poetry, you know, epic poetry. Anyway, they controlled for that, but this study did not account for treadmill walking versus outdoor walking. And although the study hasn't been done, to my knowledge, I don't know of a study that's done this to compare treadmill walking versus outdoor walking on this question of divergent and convergent thinking. My speculation, again, having not done this research, but my speculation would be you would see greater creativity in people walking in the natural environment, in a park around a college campus, versus walking on a treadmill in a room with just squares on the walls with nothing else going on. Again, a speculation, but that's what I would hypothesize.
Yeah, and in this article, you talk about background noises in the brain. What are background noises and how does this relate to walking and its benefits?
So background noise is a weird word. I use the word because that's what neuroscientists call it. But to me, I don't think they're really background at all. They are the vast majority of what's going on in the brain. And what are they? So if you were to lay down and close your eyes and just not think of any particular thing, your brain would still be active. In fact, metabolically speaking, it would be using virtually just as much energy as it would be if you were reading a book or walking around, having conversation. It is active at all times. What's it doing? Well, the neurons in your brain, they're all firing across the brain, all the areas of the brain. It is active. Now, what is it doing when you're laying there with your eyes closed? The neurons are firing all over the place. What are they doing? We don't know because there's not any event correlation. Nothing is happening. Like, that's a lot of how neuroscience has proceeded historically, is it's focused on sort of event potentials of like stimulus. If we do this, what's the response? But the problem with brain activity is 95% of it is unconscious and it doesn't seem to have any direct causal or even correlative response to what's happening. A very small portion of it does, or can, I should say. That's what neuroscience has focused on. The 5%, the tip of an enormous iceberg that they've put a lot of energy into establishing systems of correlation at a very small level. But they've called background noise all of the other neuronal firings in your brain. They've called it background noise because they don't know what to do with it. They're not really sure what causes it. They definitely know that it's not caused by background noise from the measurement apparatus that's used to measure the electrical impulses. They know that the source of it is not reducible to the influence of heartbeats on the brain or the lungs or bodily movements. They've sort of extracted and seen where the correlations between breathing and heart rate and all those things are. And then sort of once they've bracketed those out, they're still left with an enormous amount of brain activity, which doesn't seem to be correlated to anything. So they often call it random, or they call it noise, or they call it background, but it is the vast majority of what's going on. And when you call it random, it kind of sounds like it's not that big of a problem. And you're like, oh, well, it's not correlated to anything, so it's maybe not that important. Well, it turns out that it is actually very important, and the brain is using an enormous amount of energy proportional. 20% of the body's energy is being used just to keep the brain idling. And when you do something, some kind of task, some kind of specific thought, some conscious awareness of something, it's just using a really tiny portion. And the vast majority of energy is being used by these fluctuations, which is to say, apparently unknown brain activity of unknown origin and consequence.
And how does walking fit into these fluctuations or the way that the brain may work with this, yeah, quote unquote, background noise?
So when we walk, and again, this is probably tied to outdoor conditions as well, and I think it most certainly is, and another body of research related to brain activity and natural patterns, they stimulate the brain in a certain way. That's most certainly what's also going on, is being in nature is affecting the brain state, and walking is affecting the brain state, and walking in nature is affecting the brain state sort of together. And now to pull those things apart, I don't think all the studies have been done to precisely pull those variables apart quite yet, but there's a strong correlation between walking, which increases divergent thinking, and the state of your brain when you are divergently thinking. Well, what's going on in the brain when you are divergently thinking? It turns out that what's going on in the brain in that particular brain state is typically what's called alpha waves. And alpha waves are relatively slower. They're slower than, for example, gamma, which is quite fast. A high frequency, that's like when you're really focusing and concentrating on something. Alpha waves are when you are more relaxed. The social psychologists that study this, the experience of a kind of attention, they tend to call it soft attention. And that's the kind of attention when you are going for a walk and you're looking at trees and you're looking at plants, your eyes are moving around. And the ways that your eyes are moving around, looking at things, you're not trying to do anything. You're just taking a walk. You're just kind of wandering around. And so your brain goes into this mode where you're not doing anything, this kind of task-oriented activity, and it shifts over to what neuroscientists call the default mode network. And that's a big word that just means what your brain's doing when it's not doing something actively, like it's not, there's not a task. They used to call it task negative, but now it's called default mode network. And it's just like, it tends to be, not exclusively, but it tends to be in these alpha patterns, slow patterns. You're relatively relaxed. You are more creative in these states. You are more freely associative, which is why when you go for a walk, you often sort of have ideas that thoughts kind of spontaneously come from just out of nowhere, it feels like. We call them inspiration. So what's happening when you are walking and you're looking around in nature is that these spontaneous fluctuations, they're active. And we don't know what they're doing because, again, it's not task-oriented. It's not correlated to some activity. What we see is an increase in the spontaneous fluctuations that are associated with the divergent thinking. So again, this is a correlation. The precise mechanisms are not yet known. Much of what is called spontaneous fluctuations, there's not a lot known. We are very much at the beginning of studying these things. I mean, of course, certain insights about the default mode network and the activity has been known for a very long time, but any kind of answer to the question, well, what are all these spontaneous fluctuations doing? That is not fully known. That is what some of the most recent, to my mind, the most exciting and interesting research in neuroscience is trying to do, is figure out, you know, all of this supposed background noise that we've been, you know, there's mathematical formulas and techniques that neuroscientists for, you know, about 100 years have been filtering out this noise and being like, oh, this is this background stuff that doesn't matter. We're just interested in this one frequency right here that's correlated to when you saw that bird or when you pushed this button or, well, you know, some kind of activity. So in any case, the spontaneous fluctuations, they are correlated to these states of kind of spontaneous thought, which is another category of psychology research, this whole area of spontaneous thought. So they're correlated. They are happening at the same time. It seems to be the kind of phenomenological, like the experiential of like, what do you experience while you're not doing anything? What is that experience like to not be doing something, just to be sitting there? And that experience tends to be kind of associative, kind of daydreamy. Your mind starts to wander. Again, another term that is a whole area of study, mind wandering. You didn't know, but now you know, mind wandering is a whole area of study, that experience, and what's the sort of neurological basis of mind wandering. So mind wandering, daydreaming, spontaneous thought, this is the kind of phenomenological experience we have when these spontaneous fluctuations are kind of left to their own devices without any tasks to be accomplished. And that experience is associated, again, with divergent thinking.
In your article, you also mentioned that walking with other people can be beneficial. What are some of these benefits?
So there was an interesting study about conflict resolution. The researchers were trying to figure out if walking with people would help them resolve conflicts and how it affected them socially. And they discovered that the participants who were walking together felt more empathy for one another. They felt more of a sense of collective solidarity for those people. The participants who walked with the examiner felt like, versus sitting with an examiner, the ones who were walking with the examiner felt that the examiner was more friendly, but the script was exactly the same and the tone was exactly the same. But when they walked together, they felt, you know, sort of that the experimenter was more friendly if they were walking. There's lots of reasons for this. The ones in the article that I cited are that there's a kind of a body entrainment, and entrainment just means they start to walk together. If you've noticed that, if you've ever walked with somebody, pretty soon, even though you don't immediately notice and you're not consciously trying to, your steps start to line up with each other. You know, you notice that you're taking the same, like both of the left foot goes forward and the right goes forward, all in sync, and your arms start to sway in sync with somebody else. So unconsciously, your bodies start to synchronize with other bodies. And so there's a physiological entrainment that happens with other people. And then there's also a kind of cognitive entrainment. You start to see where other people are coming from more easily when you're walking with them. And part of this has to do with, the article cites, mirror neurons. These are neurons that kind of in our brains that when we see somebody smiling, for example, we sort of, the areas in our brain that would be active if we were smiling, those begin to fire when we see someone else smiling. So we see somebody smiling and then we feel like we're smiling. And oftentimes we do smile. If somebody's sitting across from you and they're smiling and laughing, you're more likely to smile and laugh in response, even if they're just doing it. So, you know, for no reason or trying to get you to do the same, you know, it could be an interview tactic or whatever, something, but you're basically trying to trigger somebody's mirror neurons to behave in a similar way as yours. So all of those things together, they're both physiological and neurological, sort of sync up when you walk with somebody.
Do you think students would benefit from more classes being outside or having classes that include a walk while listening to a professor?
I really want to do an experiment. It's definitely going to be informal, but I really want to do an experiment. I'm trying to think if I can do, I mean, informally, but just kind of ask them some questions in the beginning of the class and as we go along. And I have two classes, so I was thinking about keeping one as a control and then one as a variable. There's too many other variables to make this any kind of formal experiment, but the class that, you know, keep one class indoors in chairs in the ugly classrooms that we have, and then take the other classroom out for a walk around our beautiful campus and see and ask them questions about their experience of learning and how much they remember. Anyway, there's a bunch of different ways that one could conduct this, but I am curious to see how the students respond. I've never taught a class entirely outside or walking around or some combination of people walking and sitting. So I'm not really sure how it will go. I know that some of the barriers are that it's really hard to hear people outside. And if we're wearing masks, then that's going to be even harder. So I was thinking about having people in smaller groups. But to answer your question, I'm not totally sure. But I will say this, all of the studies that I've read strongly suggest that the students, even if they look like they're not paying attention, which has been my experience of teaching outside, I'm talking, they look like they are not even in this world. They are daydreaming. They are looking at trees. They're looking at other people. Even if they're not looking at their phones, they are definitely, from what I can tell, not listening to anything that I'm saying to them. And of course, that feels exhausting because it's hard to talk to somebody who looks like they're not listening to what you're saying. But I guess teachers, we have a thick skin for that at this point, hopefully. Anyway, even though they look like they're not paying attention, all the studies show is that they will remember what is being said better because they are outside. So if they are walking, they're going to remember more because they're walking. The other interesting thing about memory as well in these studies is related, and I've definitely done this in classes before, but doodling. Studies in education show that doodling, it's sort of, because what it does, what doodling, what walking, what being outside, because your eyes are wandering too. When you walk, your body wanders. When you look around outside, your eyes are wandering. And I mean that in a technical sense of visual wandering. The patterns that your eyes are following, you don't recognize what they're doing. But if you put a computer, you know, like a helmet onto your head that monitored your eye movement, you would see distinct patterns of eye movement that have a very specific type of pattern to them. And it's wandering. It's a very kind of freely associative, to use the exact term, but it's a fractal pattern that the eyes move. And it's a strategic pattern. It's the same pattern. If you lost your keys, you would go look for them and you would follow this pattern. Your eyes follow that pattern because, well, of thousands of years, hundreds, thousands, millions of years of evolution, that it's a very good way to hunt. It's a good way to look for something in the world, this specific type of pattern, which is a very long movement and then a bunch of short ones in a very short area and then a long movement. And that alternation between long and short and the ratio of long movements to short movements is a very specific pattern. In any case, all of these activities, even though students' eyes are wandering, their minds are wandering, their bodies are wandering, and their hands are wandering if they're doodling, all the studies, and these are separate fields of research, but all of the articles that I've read show that in each of these areas, you will remember better because that's what you were doing. If you put students in a classroom, they are less likely, even though they look like they are paying attention, they are less likely to remember what's going on in that classroom than if they were outside looking like they weren't paying attention. So to answer your question, all of the studies show that my students should remember more and learn more, but I have never tried it before. And so I'm curious to find out.
Going on from you, you know, saying sitting in class doesn't show to be as maybe potentially as effective to remember things as walking or doodling or just moving. Do you think that a lot of education systems put too much emphasis on rationality and convergent ways of thinking and ought to put more weight on imaginative mind wanderings?
Absolutely. I mean, think about what we're doing. It's kind of, and from a historical perspective, it's sort of crazy. It's absolutely just amazing that we've even thought that this was a possibility. You take millions of years of human evolution, of hominids to Homo sapiens, like the vast majority of human history in its forms has all been in nature, outside, looking around, walking. That's what our bodies have been doing for a really long time. When you force your eyes to look at a book, it's just, it takes your natural eye patterns want to move in this kind of exploratory way because they are used to looking at patterns in nature, which are largely fractal patterns. So your eyes want to look around as if, because they're trained to over a long period of evolution to look around at fractal patterns, but then you show them something for a long time that's not even remotely fractal, like words on a page. As any student can attest, it's exhausting to sit there and look at a book or to be in a classroom where there are virtually no interesting fractal patterns to look at. There's typically no art on the walls. Even if there is some art, it's certainly not fractal. The best shot you have is looking out the window. But of course, that's frowned on historically as daydreaming, not paying attention. But those students who look out that window and are looking at nature are much more likely actually to be more creative, to remember things. And the way that we remember things, all of the research on memory shows that we remember things spatially. Makes sense. We spent millions of years roaming around the savannah, hunting and gathering, and remembering things spatially as we moved around and experienced them. And so when we try to remember really abstract stuff of like, you know, recite to me all of Kant's 12 categories or something like that, you know, of consciousness, like they're just like these totally abstract things. Or remember the series of dates, you know, for World War II. It's just like, I wasn't there. I don't know. Like that just sounds like a lot of, you know, abstract information, but you still have to remember it. Or in, you know, medical school, you have to remember all these, you know, all this anatomy and all this vocabulary. And, you know, we put a lot of emphasis on just abstract memorization. And that is absolutely exhausting. It's not the way our brains were kind of have grown up to work. So I do think that trying to integrate the things that we want to remember with the ways that we have remembered and the way that our brains work, which is very spatialized, is to be outside, walking around and living those things. Even if it's a conversation we're having, you're more likely to remember it if you were in space. I've had this exact same experience. I'm not sure if you had, but if you walk in an area like I walk around campus enough, some parts of campus are associated for me with certain ideas. When I pass them, I think about the time that I was talking with somebody while we had passed this tree or this, you know, pond or whatever, and those ideas are triggered. That's like, that is, and this, that's what the Stoics did. They walked around and they had their philosophy was associated, you know, it was the Stoa, the Greek Stoa was, it means porch, and it was this long porch with all this art. And they would go to the paintings and they would talk philosophy and associate and discuss the paintings. And so the paintings and the columns and the porches, the places embodied those ideas. And so when they passed those, they would recall those ideas. And it was a way to kind of remember the philosophy and go through the steps of the philosophical system.
Currently, New Zealand is in lockdown. What's something we can take away from this research as a country that is now going for more walks due to gym and other facilities being closed?
Well, I think that's certainly, that's been my experience of walking a lot more because of the pandemic. I'm not meeting, you know, I'm not meeting with students indoors. The university is sort of closed off for now and has been closed off. But if we're outside, I feel safer, you know, being vaccinated and walking around and having conversations while walking outside is a lot safer during the pandemic. It's one of the motivations for teaching a class outside, even though I've wanted to do it for a long time. The fact that my university is about to start up and we're all going to be indoors, even with masks and being vaccinated, the Delta variant is so aggressive that I don't feel completely confident about it. I'd feel much safer if we were all outside walking. The other thing too, is if you are stuck on Zoom, you know, I know a lot of professors, including myself, want students to be, you know, visually, you know, like on a video or something like that. You know, I've seen a lot of students who are outside with their laptops, you know, I can tell that they're outside from the Zoom thing, or you can have meetings while walking. So I'm walking right now and, you know, you can have meetings while you're moving and you just audio. So I've taken a lot of meetings just by phone call and just skip the Zoom entirely. And I just walk around campus and have my meetings. And it's, you know, it's always weird and disembodied. You're missing that, you know, you're missing that entrainment with some other body walking around. That's ideal. But if you can't have that, at least you can be outside looking around at nature, you know, physically moving your body and still, you know, participating to some degree in your education. Some people can work from home. I have a friend who just works, his job is entirely from home, and he walks just tons and tons and tons. He's in meetings all day long and he just walks. So that's another option.
That was Thomas Nail, a professor of philosophy at the University of Denver in the United States, talking about the benefits walking has on the brain. Also, if you would like to read Thomas Nail's article about his research, you can find that on salon.com.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.